Paleolithic. But before we get started on the Middle Paleolithic, I'd like to follow up on a couple of points about the final stages of the Lower Paleolithic, about the Acheulean here in the Near East, and especially here in Jordan. And I'd also like to clarify something. Here in the Near East, the Lower Paleolithic is the Acheulean. The Acheulean is a culture, a single culture, primarily defined by the number of, by the presence of hand axes. In other parts of the world, the Lower Paleolithic has other cultures, such as the Clactonium, which is a culture found primarily in England and Northern Europe. It does not have hand axes, but it is also in the Lower Paleolithic. So the Lower Paleolithic is a broad term encompassing a number of cultures of the same date, the same age. But here in the Near East, the only culture that we have is the Acheulean. The entire Acheulean.
Paleolithic is a period, right?
Yeah, Paleolithic is a general period primarily indicating this first 900,000 years, or in fact, the first 2.5 million years. It's a general kind of thing. We'll get to the Middle Paleolithic. And here in the Near East, we have several different cultures. So the Middle Paleolithic encompasses several cultures quite distinct from the Lower Paleolithic in terms of technique, the kinds of tools they rely on, and of course the age they were made. Now, we talked last time about the Jaji and about Einel Esed, and how different they were in terms of the kinds of hand axes they were making. Remember, the cleavers were very, very important to Einel Esed, but not important at the Jaji, and that the Lvalois technique was very important at Fajaji, but not at Einel Esed. There are a couple of sites in Palestine that give us some more clues as to what's going on. Remember, we brought up the possibility that the reason for these differences was function or culture. Well, I think we might be able to suggest it is culture, because in terms of function, we've got some other sites in Palestine which indicate that functions do not explain these differences. Now, if we look not at the hand axes or the cleavers at Einel Esed, but the flake tools themselves, primarily the scrapers, the gravers, knives, choppers, chopping tools, we find that those percentages of tools are almost exactly equivalent to the material from the late Acheulean at Tabun Cave in Mount Carmel. Exactly the same percentages of convex scrapers. Exactly the same percentages as concave scrapers. There's a wide variety of scraper types, a wide variety of knife types, yet all these percentages are almost exactly the same. The same is for Fajaji. Its flake tool component. I did that wrong. I can blame it on my cold. It's Fajaji that is almost exactly the same as Tabun Cave, not Einel Esed. Einel Esed has exactly the same kind of tool percentages as a site called Kisufim on the Mediterranean coast just outside of Gaza. Now, these three sites, Kisufim, Einel Esed, and Fajaji, are all open-air sites. That is, they are just out in the field someplace. That's where you would find them today. Tabun is the only one that is a cave site. We would expect that Tabun, Kisufim, and Einel Esed would all be different. Tabun would be different from Einel Esed and from Kisufim, because it's a different kind of domestic situation. Here the people are living inside an enclosure, whereas these people are living in the open. That would be an expected functional difference. So we might explain, for example, here at Tabun, almost no Lvalois technique at all. Here Einel Esed and Kisufim. Kisufim has a lot of Lvalois technique, but we would expect the tools to be different simply because the people are living in a much wider area. Certainly, we would not expect Tabun and Fajaji to be similar. Fajaji has a lot of almost 50% Lavalwa technique. Tabun has nothing. Yet the flight tools themselves, the types, the kinds of tools that we're using, are almost identical. So we can't say that functionally these differences are explained. We have to say that probably there is a cultural association between these two and not a functional association, not a functional difference. So because here we have cave site and open air sites, here we have Lavalwa technique, no Lavalwa technique. Here we might be able to use functional differences. Maybe the Lavalwa technique was not usable in the cave, or the tools made by Lavalwa technique were not suitable for the domestic kinds of work that was done inside the cave, but it was outside. Anyway, it's kind of intriguing to see these two sites which have no Lavalwa, these two sites which do have Lavalwa, but they're actually more similar to other sites. You know, it's kind of a jumbled up sort of situation. It's an intriguing kind of situation. Any questions? Did I make that pretty well muddled or not? Anyway. So, at about 80,000 BC, we start to see another major change in the way people were making their stone tools and going about their daily life. We enter into a period called the Middle Paleolithic. This is the period, and we first encounter in Palestine a culture called the Yabrudian. This is a term named after a cave site or a rock shelter site in Syria called Yabrud, which was excavated by a German named Rust in 1950. An exciting cave, and he first identified a middle Paleolithic culture there and thus gave it its name. The Yabrudian, like the lower Paleolithic, does have hand axes, but the hand axes are very crude. They are very short. Usually they're not much longer than that. Compared to that long one we had last time for the late Acheulean, and you can see that there's been a degeneration in terms of these hand axes. They're short, squat, thick, and generally crudely made. That beautiful symmetry, that attention to fine craftsmanship, especially as it was expressed in hand axes, has disappeared. It now just becomes a mere functional tool that you use and throw away as soon as you're done with it or something. Very little time and care given to the manufacture of hand axes during this period. Now, even though hand axes are made in the Yabrudian, they are not made in as many numbers. But in terms of their relative importance as butchering tools, the Yabrudians have developed other kinds of tool types to take some of the uses of hand axes away. These are primarily called, with quotes around it, scrapers. Scrapers is unfortunately a name that was applied to tool types back in the 1860s, the 1870s by the French, just when prehistory was beginning to get off the ground. Scrapers, of course, suggest they're for scraping things, but on the other hand, they probably were used for a multitude of reasons. Scrapers, if you have a cross section of a scraper, you can have scrapers that have very steep edges. You can have scrapers that have moderate edges like this, and you can have scrapers with extremely sharp edges. Now, obviously, or at least on the basis of logic alone, these three kinds of tools would have different uses. I think this one would be very difficult to use as a scraper. You'd probably break that edge off very quickly. I think the scrapers were used more as knives than they were as scraping tools themselves. But on the other hand, some kinds of scrapers probably had more than one use by itself. It could be used as a knife or a scraper. But anyway, the Yabrudian is very heavily dependent on these scrapers. Generally more than 50% of the tools will be scrapers, whereas in the Acheulean period before, all of the flake tools combined would make up only 50%, including the hand axes. Pardon me, I've still got some of this cold and it makes me perspire a little bit. In general, to look at a group of artifacts from the Ubrutian period, one is struck by the lack of elegance. All of the flakes, as I already mentioned, the hand axes, the flakes are short, very thick, broad, nothing to really capture our imagination in terms of the care that these people went into to make these kinds of materials. It seems to be, in general terms, a degeneration of spirit, if I can use this British approach to describing this material. It's just a loss of apparent skill. Not that they couldn't make excellent material, but there simply seems to have been no reason to do so. The Ubrutian, in general, lasts for about 30 years. It ends at about 50,000. But there is something that's very curious that happens right near the middle of this period. And that is the appearance of some artifacts of a culture that is so strikingly contrasting to the general crude nature of this, that it's a shock. This is the appearance of something called the pre-Aurignacian culture. Now, Aurignacian is a term used for an upper Paleolithic culture in Europe. And when Rust was excavating at Ubrud Cave, he went through a series of upper Paleolithic material. Then he came into a Mousterian level, a middle Paleolithic level. And then he came into the upper Paleolithic again, he thought. And then under this upper Paleolithic level, he started finding the Ubrutian and then eventually the Acheulean. What he had postulated was that with the pre-Aurignacian between the Mousterian and the Ubrutian, that there was a group of people running around here who were retarded. These Mousterian people were not advancing like other people were, and they kind of hung around and entered the cave after the upper Paleolithic people had been there for a while, lived in the cave for a while, and then they left, and upper Paleolithic people came back and established themselves forever. That seemed to be a pretty good explanation at the time, but then more work done in Lebanon especially indicated that Rust was incorrect in his interpretation, that this in fact was not an upper Paleolithic form. It certainly did not fit in terms of time, because in these Lebanese caves called Atlun and Bezez up near Beirut, the pre-Aurignacian was sitting comfortably right in the middle of the Ubrutian. A long sequence of Ubrutian beneath this pre-Aurignacian level, and then a long sequence of Ubrutian after it. And then finally, again, at Taboon Cave, where an American from Arizona was excavating, they found, again, a single layer of pre-Aurignacian smack dab in the middle of the Ubrutian. And it's been dated tentatively at 60,000. Now, the elegance of this material is very, very evident. The crude, almost sloppy nature of the flakes of Ubrutian is contrasted by nice, long, thin, slender blades, time after time after time. And with three major kinds of tool types. The end scraper, where just the tip of a blade is retouched. The burin, or the graver. where one of the sharp edges is intentionally removed to form a perpendicular edge. By striking the tip of a blade along the length of an edge, you take off a flake from here, and you're left with an edge that's perpendicular to the surfaces. And the tip of this forms a chisel-like edge, and it's used for probably, at least this is the way it was used in the Upper Paleolithic, probably for graving bone, either for making bone tools or for just making designs on bone and wood as well. So, end scrapers and burins, and then finally, backed knives. Where one edge of the blade was intentionally blunted by just nibble retouch, just removing the sharpness of the edge. This edge was probably not used with this retouch. It probably was made so that if the person was going to use it, it would not be cutting his finger as he used as a knife for slicing. So these three artifacts suddenly appear in very large number for a very brief period, and then disappear again. And we're back to the crude Ubrudian. The Ubrudian, which relies on side scrapers, transverse scrapers, and canted scrapers. Side scraper would be generally on a flake where an edge often had a convex contour on it. The transverse scraper is again a flake where the scraping edge, again generally convex, is made on the end of the flake. This is where the flake was struck to remove it from the core. This is the transverse. And then the canted was sort of a combination of the two, where at least one side, one lateral edge, was retouched, and the end. These are all very thick, and they're all flakes, they're all crummy looking compared to the material in pre-ordination. Now, getting back to the name pre-ordination, it's attached to these people, it's attached to the culture, because this is exactly what happens in the Upper Paleolithic. Burins, end scrapers, and back knives are the major tools, almost nothing else except for boring implements, piercing implements, are made during the Upper Paleolithic. Yet it comes in at 60,000 BC, almost 30,000 years before the Upper Paleolithic itself begins. Now, how does this happen? Some people have said, well, we've got modern Homo sapiens sapiens running around someplace in southwestern Russia. They always say that. Whenever anything appears, it's always from southwestern Russia, primarily because nobody's done any work up there. They don't know what's up there, so that's a likely place for these mysterious people to have come from. The Ubrudians are definitely Neanderthals. We really don't have an answer. Pre-ordination has appeared in only four sites. All four of them are cave sites. All but one are on the Mediterranean coast. They do have a very short life, evidently. In Tabun Cave, for example, the pre-ordination layer was not more than 2 centimeters thick, separated by 3 meters of Ubrudian below it and a meter of Ubrudian above it. So that's it's a very, very short live thing. We really don't know where these people came from. We don't know where they went. It's possible that this is a special toolkit that the Ubrudians used very rarely. Primarily, they used them outside, so we don't find them in the caves. But if this is the case, why don't we find pre-ordination out in the open? We still haven't found any pre-ordination. On the other hand, since it looks so much like Upper Paleolithic, perhaps some of the Upper Paleolithic sites, so-called Upper Paleolithic sites, actually are pre-ordination. Very difficult to resolve this, and we're just going to have to leave it hanging up there, dangling in the wind. We really don't know. It's just a strange phenomenon, It comes in very rapidly and leaves very suddenly as well. Near the end of the Ubrutian, once the Ubrutians come back in and occupy these sites, eventually they give way, or they stop making hand axes. Whatever functions hand axes had, as butchering implements or as skin cleaning implements, scraping implements, they evidently have now been superseded by this other wide variety of flake tool types instead. Throughout the entire history, throughout the 80,000 to 50,000 period, the Levallois technique is not used at all. Ah, you might find two or three Levallois flakes, but you can make mistaken Levallois flakes. So these are probably mistakes. But the people do not use Levallois technique. Now, remember, I'm talking about Palestine so far. Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, not Jordan. At about 50,000 BC, something as dramatic as this pre-Aurignacian, quote, invasion, unquote, takes place in Palestine. The Ubrutian gives way to a mouthful of culture called the Levallois-Wazo Mousterian. The Mousterian is a term that derives from a cave site in France, Le Moustier, which gave its name to the Middle Paleolithic in France. It was imported wholesale over here into the Near East by British and American and German archaeologists of the 1930s. Levallois-Wazo is a good clue to what their techniques rely on. In the Levallois-Wazo Mousterian, the techniques are, of course, dominated by the Levallois technique. More than 50% of the flakes, the blades, and the points are made by this pre-shaping the core technique to make Levallois points, Levallois flakes, and Levallois blades. Now, there's no use of the Levallois technique in the Ubrutian. Suddenly, at 50,000 BC, bang, this stuff just swarms all over the Near East at the same time, at least in Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon. How? Why? A Ubrutian technique, this clumsy, crude manner of fashioning flakes, is suddenly usurped by these very elegant pieces. Elegant in terms of their thinness. A nice point, you'll have to pardon this, goat stepped on it or something and ruined one edge, otherwise an excellent point. Nice, elegant Levallois blades. And again, look at the thinness of this nice Levallois flake. These things take over. They have absolutely no relationship to the preceding Ubrutian. I think it's probably true we are looking here at a real invasion. That is a real group of people that more or less quickly comes in from some other place, not necessarily Southwest Russia this time, as we'll see, and somehow take over the area once dominated by the Ubrutian. Now, are we speaking about warfare? Who knows? We can't tell. This may have taken 1,000 years to take place, which is relative, which is rapid in terms of these long periods we're talking about. But I don't think we can suggest that there was necessarily any kind of warfare going on with Levallois points chalking up points on this side and Ubrutian scrapers chalking up points on that. We don't know how this transition took place. But obviously, it's not a transition from one culture developing into another. It's a wholesale replacement. In the earlier part of the Levallois and Mousterian, you might say from 50,000 to approximately 45,000 perhaps. And let's take it down to 42,000. This is just a guess date. We see a change in this early Levallois Mousterian to the late. In the early Levallois Mousterian, we have a primary reliance on tools made on Levallois points and on Levallois blades. There are Levallois flakes, but they're not very numerous. In relative terms. Now, the Valois points, we suspect, were primarily used as spear points, but we also see that they were used as special kinds of scrapers and, again, special kinds of knives. Certainly, the Valois blades were used as knives and certain kinds of scrapers. In contrast to the pre-Aurignacian or the Upper Paleolithic, which relies on blades, the Valoisian Wisterian almost never has burins, end scrapers, and back knives on Valois blades. So just another difference, we can't explain it, but it is a difference to identify. And then from about 42,000 or 40,000 to 35,000, we see instead a heavy reliance on these broad, thin, beautifully elegant Valois flakes, with a consequent decline in the reliance on points and blades. They still make points and blades and they use them, but they don't use them as much. One of the explanations for this could be how the cave itself was used. The cave at Tabun, the cave at Mukatafa, the cave at Bezez, the cave at Atmu. Most of this material comes from cave sites that in Palestine, anyway. In the early part, they may have done most of their butchering inside the cave, so they needed a lot of blades and a lot of points or something. In the late Acheulean, most of the butchering may have taken place on the terraces out front, and other kinds of domestic activities were done inside the cave instead. We're guessing here, we don't know. That might be one explanation for it. So, we can ask again this question, probably with no answer, but we can ask again. Why the sudden explosion of the Valois technique? Where did it come from to replace the Abrutians? Well, let's come over to Jordan a little bit and see what we have around here. First thing we don't have around here is Abrutian. There's no Abrutian known in Jordan at all. Last week, I said I might be talking through my hat when I suggested that the Wadi Mujib may have been a cultural boundary. No Valois technique in the north, or very little, versus a lot of technique in the south. Now, I may have been talking through my hat. I've just been looking at some of the material that Ted Banning has recovered from his survey in the Wadi Ziklab by Irbid, and there is some very nice Valois material in there. Maybe this cultural boundary didn't exist. But there does seem to be another cultural boundary. Here in Highland Jordan, at least below the Wadi Mujib, tremendous amount of Valoiso Mousterian. Big question mark up here in the north, we're not sure. It may be another kind of Mousterian or Middle Paleolithic. But one thing is certain, there is absolutely no Abrutian. No hand axes associated with thick, crude scrapers are known here. Valoiso Mousterian obviously develops from the Acheulean that had all of that Valois material, like at Fajaji. Tremendous numbers of Valois cores, flakes, and blades. For some reason, they stop making the hand axes. They develop into this culture, Valoiso Mousterian, and they just sit there. They sit there for a very long time. It looks like the earliest part of the Valoiso Mousterian is also dominated by blades and points, with Valois flakes being made, but not very much, just like in the earliest part of the Palestinian sequence. On the other hand, this, I think, is probably much older than the Palestinian sequence. Recall that at this time, it's a major ice advance in the north, in Europe and in Asia. Increased rainfall here in the Near East. Formation of Lake Lisan, which in fact went all the way up into parts of Lebanon, southern Lebanon. That certainly did form a real barrier. Not just a cultural barrier, but a physical barrier. A physical barrier that in fact probably influenced the exchange of cultural information from Palestine to Highland Jordan. There's one good bridge, and it's down here in the Wadi Araba to the Negev Desert. Now, there's another question mark down here. Is there any Abrutian in the Negev Desert?
I don't know. I've been over here for a couple of years now and haven't been able to read the pertinent journals. But certainly the Abrutian is all over the mountainous section and the coast of Palestine at the same time. Now, if the Levalloiso-Mousterian is going to suddenly replace the Abrutian here, the easiest place to look for the antecedents for the homeland of the Levalloiso-Mousterian must be at least in southern Jordan, crossing the Wadi Araba into Palestine and replacing all of the Abrutian cultures there. It's not necessary to go all the way up in southwestern Russia this time, thank God. Certainly there was a very real absence of contact across the Lausanne. The Abrutian, we would suspect, did not develop from the Acheulean with a lot of Levallois. In fact, it probably developed from the Acheulean like at Toboum Cave. A lot of hand axes, no Levallois technique. This changing to the Abrutian. Here we have the Acheulean with a lot of Levallois technique, changing to the Levalloiso-Mousterian. Then for some reason, the Abrutians are removed. They remove themselves, they intermarry with people across here and agree to bring up their children as practicing Levalloiso-Mousterians instead of Abruti. I don't know. But it certainly seems that that wholesale very tentative about that. The more I see of Ted stuff from Irvin, the antsier I get about this nice little cultural differentiation. Now here in Jordan, the Levalloiso-Mousterian, as I may have mentioned before, also seems to follow the same general development. The early Levalloiso-Mousterian dominated by blades and by points, the later Levalloiso-Mousterian dominated by the flakes, although there a few points and blades are still being made. There may in fact be an earlier early Levalloiso-Mousterian here that's equivalent in time to the Abrutian, where the platform, the striking platform of these points and blades especially, is formed either by this, what's called a chapeau de gendarme platform, like this, or that earlier one may have been flat. We have a lot of information now on sites in the Wadi El Hessa especially, with some sites with a lot of these curved platforms, some sites without those curved platforms. The platforms are simply straight like that. So one may be earlier than the other, but we've never found one in situ where we can excavate it and get a real date for it. That's one of the problems. So I suggest that we have a beginning Levalloiso-Mousterian with probably plain platforms, developing into these sort of classy ones, and then going into the upper Levalloiso-Mousterian with the flakes. I have to feed my cold here. Now, in terms of the people who are making, especially the Levalloiso-Mousterian, we've got very good skeletal material from Palestine in those caves. We also have material from Iraq, Shanidar Cave. Well, this is the very famous one where a person was buried with a lot of flowers on them, apparently. This is determined by looking at the pollen. Flowers that they've found hyacinth, jonquil or something, I don't know what the flowers are. But apparently this Neanderthal fellow was placed in the grave, a lot of flowers placed over him, and then covered up. Some nice symbolism going on. There's a lot of nice symbolism going on in Europe at this time as well. Families being buried together. A father next to the mother, two children, and an infant at the foot of the mother's burial. A lot of nice things starting to happen.
showing the real humanity of these so-called brutish Neanderthals.
You assume they all died at the same time.
Or they were murdered at the same time. Maybe they're not so humane after all. Who knows? In the lower Valois, the Valoisian in Palestine, the Neanderthals are very rugged. That is, if you looked at the heads, would have a sloping forehead, not as vertical as ours, a heavy bone shelf over the eye, and a jaw with no chin. All right, it's starting to look like a cartoon character, but I can't help it. Sort of an elongated head, more or less, but he does kind of look brutish, naked like this. In the upper Levalloiser Mousterian, we see something different happening. Oops, I shouldn't have removed that. In the upper Levalloiser Mousterian, we see a very human-looking, modern human-looking skull. The definite presence of a chin, a more vertical forehead, but the teeth and that heavy brow ridge still remain. It looks like at the sites of Skul in Mount Carmel, just around the corner from Tabun Cave by about 100 meters, and another site called Kavze, very near Nazareth. At those two sites, there are, what, Scott, 30? About 30 burials, all with these very modern human-looking features, and all associated with the Valoisian Mousterian. The suggests is that the people are developing physically, first towards modern Homo sapiens, and then later on, they will, within a couple of thousand years, they will develop the first real human cultures, the upper Paleolithic culture. But we see biology working before culture working. Very intriguing material. We also, at Skul Cave, for example, there's a burial of a man with these more or less modern features, and he has crooked in the elbow of one of his arms a scraper of some kind, I don't recall what the scraper is, and in the other arm is the jaw of a wild boar. Now, was he killed by the boar? Was his name Bill Wild Boar, or whatever, he was his favorite meal, but again, it suggests some kind of symbolism, symbolic communication with the dead, with the afterworld, with whatever goes on. Very intriguing. Now, one of the things that's very nice about this is that we're starting to see a development towards a upper Paleolithic kind of culture. The blades are becoming more delicate. The points are becoming almost spiky instead of the nice broad flakes like points like this. They're becoming more spike-like instead. But in contrast now, these we might call, or some people have been would call, the progressives. In contrast, in Europe, it looks like something is happening just the other direction. That the rugged Neanderthals are becoming even more rugged. The bone is becoming thicker over the head. Massive skulls. They're becoming more and more Neanderthal, less and less modern Homo sapiens sapiens. And the same thing is happening with the Mousterian culture. The flakes that they rely on, whether Levallois or not, because they don't always use Levallois technique, the flakes are becoming shorter, but it's becoming wider, and they're becoming chunkier, much thicker. It's a complete reversal of the trend here
towards modern Homo sapiens sapiens. Now, one explanation has been that during this time, the glaciers had almost cut off any contact between Europe and the Near East. Certainly, there was no contact across northern Africa. So these people were forming an isolated gene pool. They could no longer share whatever was happening here. They couldn't share the genes of this evolution. And they were more or less sort of kicking themselves into extinction when the weather patterns changed. And we don't know why these people were doing that. We don't know why the Neanderthals are suddenly replaced so quickly in Europe, but it looks like the development was happening very rapidly here. And again, the Near East may have been so-called fountain of humanity. Baloney, stuff like that.
Is he Homo sapiens?
No, he's still Neanderthal, his teeth especially, and this big, heavy brow ridge. Plus, he's also associated with a Mousterian or a Middle Paleolithic culture. So far, there are no Neanderthal skeletal remains known here in Jordan. Probably we will be very, very lucky indeed if we ever do find any. Most of the sites we have here are not cave sites. The caves, as I mentioned before last week, all seem to be very, very recent, or the caves that are old enough to have material like this have been reused so many times, especially by Bronze Age people and later, that everything has been cleaned out. There's simply nothing left from the lower or middle Paleolithic. We might be lucky enough in some of the surveys, like Scott Rawlson's survey down at the Wadi Bayou. We are lucky enough to find material protected some way from the terrible wind deflation, especially the wind blowing the sediments away that would normally protect skeletal material. We hope so, but I'm not too confident anymore. Now, the change from the Middle Paleolithic to the Upper Paleolithic is a very gradual one here. In Europe, it's fairly abrupt in some places. A sudden change from the Mousterian flake industries to the Upper Paleolithic blade industries. Recall that in the Preoric Nation, for example, the reason it looks so much like an Upper Paleolithic culture is because everything in the Upper Paleolithic, practically everything, is made on a blade. Now here that change is very gradual. The first stage of the Upper Paleolithic I, is in fact dominated by the Levallois technique. It is found in association with skeletal material that is completely Homo sapiens sapiens. Gone are those, that heavy brow ridge, the chin is always present, the teeth are very modern looking. Upper Paleo I again relies on an awful lot of Levallois points, but one of the nice things that makes it very distinguishable from the Middle Paleolithic is if you look at the other side, they have thinned that bulb of percussion that used to be there. What used to be there, now they've taken off flakes to make this thing easier to put on the end of a shaft. We've got one here that you can take a look at a little bit later. Didn't do a very good job on this one, but this may have been a kid trying to learn from his father, I don't know. But this is very, very diagnostic. It has the term Amira point. Named after a cave in Palestine very close to Lake Tiberias called the Mira. And it is the sort of index fossil for the earliest Upper Paleolithic. There are also Mira elements. Where instead of points being thinned at the bulb, it would do the same thing to blades and also to flakes. It would intentionally thin that bulb to put it in a handle of some kind. I don't know what you're going to put this thing into a handle, but it seems to be a very characteristic thing for all of the
or most of the flakes and blades points. And in fact, Ted found one Lavalwa flake with this Amira thinning on one side. And the Wadi El Hessa, last year we found, I think, four different sites with Amira points on them. And in that one survey season alone, I think we increased the number of Amira point sites by 100%. It's very lucky, really was. I think we will stop here tonight and go on with the development of the Upper Paleolithic and the Epi-Paleolithic next week. And that will lead us right back full circle to the Neolithic, and we will discuss again the pre-pottery Neolithic B, not just in terms of Jericho and Beta and Ein Ghazal, but in terms of the desert and the Song, which seems to have preceded this Bronze Age wars by quite a bit. So, are there any questions?
How long does one period
last? It's never been satisfactorily dated, but you could say 2,000 or 3,000 years. It begins at about 35,000 and maybe ends at 31,000. Okay, coffee and cookies, I hope.